cetera, that I didn't know why they were there, and I deleted them. Turns out that Julia, who's the eldest, this was her electronic scrapbook. This is where she kept her favorite pictures of her friends, her favorite music, you know, email that was very important to her, and I had obliterated it. So I was, any of you who have deal with children or spouses, and she, you know, she's a very tough kid. She played varsity lacrosse, had more yellow cards than any other kid in the league. So she's a thug. She's a thug who looks nice with a, you know, with a stick. Very tough kid, and she started to cry. And she told her mother, "Dad destroyed my life. You know, I am so far in the doghouse, it is scary. I mean, I am down here because this poor kid, I had destroyed her life." So I said, not knowing what to do, "Don't touch the machine. I'll call the IS people tomorrow and see what I can do to fix this." And as you, those of you who are computer scientists, know, there are utilities to help you recover files that you've destroyed. So I got one of these utilities, and I started this thing running. And I was watching the screen and seeing all these things come back. And I was up there dancing in my chair. I was high-fiving because I was going from, you know, I'll just draw you a picture of this thing. I don't know if we have, yeah, here we have chalk. This is sort of normal existence. This is heaven. This is hell. This is time, okay? I was down here. I was below hell. So whatever hell is, it wasn't as bad as I was feeling. And I was on my way up to, you know, emotionally on my way up as these files were recovering, and I was on my way close to heaven, or I was in that trajectory anyway. While I was sitting there, my wife handed me an envelope. She said, "John," on the cover, and I said, "What's this?" She said, "Happy anniversary. It was our 20th anniversary, and I had forgotten." Yeah! I was so right back down into, in fact, wherever this low point was, I was headed for a point well south of that. I'd forgotten 20 years, and I love this woman madly, and you know, been going out with her for close to 30 years now, and I had forgotten this thing. And so I went on, as males will do, males who are caught with their shorts around their ankles in a bad situation. I went on to FTD.com, and you know, I don't know if you've ever been on FTD.com. These tiny little grainy pictures, they are supposedly of flowers, but you wouldn't know it by the tiny grainy little picture. Best I can tell, it's a, you know, painting, watercolor painting that got rained on for a while. It's just this blur of colors. But it was a gazillion dollars. Shit, if that'll buy my way out of this jam. So I went in and bought a gazillion dollar blurry thing. Turned out to be very nice flowers. Now, those of you who are, I want to get in dangerous territory, but those of you who haven't done this, if you make a serious mistake with a woman, that mistake will haunt you for the rest of your life. So I am now slowly but surely, over time, crawling out of that existence back to a normal relationship. But every now and then I get reminded of it. So anyway, that was...
On technology, we're somewhere south of purgatory.
Yeah, I know. So anyway, now we have this. Let me start this. And you should, if you have questions, feel free to ask us anytime. We're not going to go through the specific business, but if you were the board at Partners, and that's, I spend time with them, they look at numbers like this. They say, "All right, John, your budget this year, this is fiscal year 03, the current fiscal year, is $114 million. If we throw in all the capital or sort of proxy for the servers and operating systems, you're spending $170 million. That's what we are spending on you, or you are spending on our behalf. It's a very big number. It can be the difference between a healthy, fiscally healthy organization and not a fiscally healthy organization. In addition to being a very big number, you're growing at a rate of 10% a year, and at least that's the compounded annual growth rate over this period of time. So that's growing twice as fast as the expenses of the hospital as a whole. So not only are you a big number, you're growing twice as fast. So the very reasonable question is, if we're spending all this money and we're expending it at a rate faster than anything else, if we have a positive margin, operating revenue, I single-handedly have the ability to lead to fiscal insolvency. And that was actually a question. How long at this rate will it take before you essentially make us, insolvent? I said approximately 8 to 9 years, best I can tell. And I will do this personally. But if it's going to grow at this rate, what are you doing for us that's useful? What is it that we're getting out of this non-trivial amount of money, plus the agony of putting these systems in, the change, et cetera? So this becomes a central conversation, and point to earlier is how do you arrive at that list of things that you are doing which are of value to this organization as a whole? And there are, if we define the nature of support, this is I am supporting the goals, the plans, the aspirations, the strategies of partners as a whole, but also the Mass General Faulkner Hospital, which is a small hospital. How is it that I arrive? There are four fundamental ways that people like me go through conversations, highly iterative conversations, that times range from very high altitudes to on the ground, nuts and bolts, rubber meets the road type joint. And there are four different ways, and I'm going to cover these, and then we're going to give examples of these. Walk through. One is that you, at times you get a goal or a strategy which you present it, you understand it, and you can begin to list a series of things you might do in the IT realm. Example, if I want to improve my ability to collect money from the payers, you can run through a list of billing systems and analysis systems and say, based on what we know in the industry, et cetera, here's a set of options that you have. And you can pick A versus B and a bunch of other stuff, but you can derive it, you know, from the strategy there. The second is that if you look at certain phenomena and you say, well, we're doing this today, but I can see where it's taking us. And we're not, the strategy doesn't talk about this, but I can see where we're going in a range of things, is that you can infer from a trajectory where you will be in 5 to 10 years. Now, let me give you an example, and we'll use a different example now. I think within 3 to 4 year period of time, more or less, maybe 4 years, we will largely have completed putting out the computerized record across partners. It'll be approximately 7,000 physicians, very large, very difficult undertaking. We'll be at the end of that era. Long time to get to this era, very difficult to do. And the question becomes, what's the era after that? So, I mean, what do? Just stop, go on vacations for a long period of time? Unlikely. The era after that is largely to be where we focus less on transaction systems, entering orders, recording findings, et cetera, and more on increasingly sophisticated application of medical knowledge to guide the doctor to avoid mistakes. So is part of it is looking at where we'll be, and I'll give you an example of that. The third says that whatever organization you are, there are a small number, my belief is fewer than 10, processes that define what you are and are the essence of what you do. So in our case in healthcare, ordering something, whether a test or a procedure or whatever, is a very fundamental process, goes on hundreds of thousands of times a day. If we do it well, then we will be a great organization. If we do it poorly, we will hurt people and waste money. If you're a bank, a fundamental activity is depositing, or a fundamental activity is reconciling or whatever. So if you look at healthcare ordering, making a referral, having someone access, in other words, find a doctor and get an appointment, very fundamental activities, regardless of strategies, regardless of what you're doing, those activities define who you are central to your prowess, and every year you ought to be making them better, every single year. And so if you're a retail, the task of finding that article that you're of interest to you is a fundamental core activity. So we do that. The next point here, and we'll actually focus a little bit on here, but primarily on these two, although we'll bring in this one as an example, is every now and then people obviously come up with new technologies. At times there's sort of basic infrastructure, the notion of mobility or wireless, for example, or even architectural ideas such as service-oriented architecture. Basic fundamental technologies, and at times they're applications. An application might be a patient and their provider talking to each other through the internet, asking questions, refilling prescriptions, things like that. So these are ideas that are on the landscape all of a sudden, and the question becomes, are they any use? Are they any good? Who cares? Because there are actually some ideas that aren't very good, or malformed, or way too early. But to take this technology orientation, say this idea, what value does it have? What utility does it have? And if we can't assess because it's too early, what experiments, what trials, what should we run, et cetera? So the way you arrive at this mix, this thing that sort of winds up spending $170 million, is a simultaneous, often, pursuit of ideas along these four fundamentally different vectors. They're all intertwined in a bunch of different ways. And again, I will illustrate these as how we go about looking at a bunch of things across the board. Now, here's an example of just deriving. I don't know how much we want to do a better job of disease management. For those of you who are not physicians, what that means is if you have a chronic disease, asthma, you're hypertensive, you're depressed, actually clinical depression is a stunningly common disease in a lot of ways, you're going to have this for the rest of your life. I mean, there's no way in a lot of ways to cure these things. What we can do is help you lead a great life, long life, free of as few debilitations as possible. We want to manage you. So if you're diabetic, we want to make sure your blood sugar levels remain well, that you don't develop high cholesterol and all this bad news that comes from that. So we want to manage you on an ongoing basis. So that's what we're going to go off and do. Reasonable thing to do, smart thing to do, morally good thing to do in a bunch of ways. What is it that I can do or that technology can do to help that? And this is very derived from this thing. Well, there's a bunch of stuff. One is there are best practices of treating asthma. There are best practices of diabetes care, and so you develop them. You ask your doctors to put them together, and you publish them through an intranet, an extranet, whatever it is. You lay them out there. So if you have questions about what's the right way to treat hypertension, is Zocor better than Lipitor as a drug, a cholesterol-lowering drug? The other is that you can actually put databases and sort of assess which, you doctors over here are terrific at managing diabetes. You guys suck. What is it that we can learn from their management that ought to be helpful to you all? What practices, what approaches do they use, and use that to arrive at better care and consistency? We can guide the documentation. So if I show up at Dr. Solovitz's office and I am diabetic, then in the computerized record system you say, Pete, Glasser's diabetic. Hence, what we want you to do is to record his blood sugar levels. We want you to record his cholesterol levels. We want you to do a foot exam because after you got to be careful of gangrene setting in, frankly. We want you to do an eye test periodically because you can actually lose your sight as a result of diabetes. So we're going to guide and make sure that Pete does the right things in treating someone. We can remind Pete to do things. We can remind me. You can send me a postcard. You can send me an email. Say, Glasser, you're diabetic. You haven't had a cholesterol test in a year. It's time to have a cholesterol test because you're at risk of very high cholesterol levels, et cetera. We can critique specific care decisions. So you generate an order for something, and we can remind you or point out related orders that need to occur or interaction probabilities or things along those lines. And then last but not least, and I think we see an example here, let's presume you have congestive heart failure. And this is where the efficiency of your heart is greatly impaired, so just getting the normal flow of blood through you is a big deal. One of the signs that your heart is not working as well as it should, you start gaining weight. You start retaining water. So we're quite interested in your weight. Very important to understand your weight. Very important to understand your blood oxygen saturation. So we can monitor you at home. You can, whether real time with sensors that beam junk, or whether you just step on a scale and stuff. But we can monitor you in a remote fashion to make sure that you're maintaining adequate levels and this, that, and the other. Point being, in this approach, is, and all these are correct, and you can decide you can't do them all, or that you only have enough money to do some of them, but this is an example of taking disease management as a strategy and arriving at a series of IT things that one might do. Now, at the end of the day, through that exercise and the others, is you want to be able to, on the strategy side, here's our goals. These are major partners' goals, hardly very controversial. We want to be financially stable. We want to integrate the system. We want to improve our care. We have a research and education mission. And as a result, largely the derivation, you want to have a list of IS initiatives on the side here. So, for example, we have to do a genetics and genomics platforms. It's going to be impressive, the amount of processing power and storage required by this kind of stuff. But we also have to support the grants management activity because we often overrun grants. We wind up eating the money. It's not a good situation here. We want to do the computerized record. We want to do order entry, things like that. And financially, we want to have a better general accounting system and the ability to account for costs, et cetera. So the point is, at the end of the day, is to have a list that looks like this. And I won't spend a lot of time here because I think actually this is suitable for boards. And just a hot tip, I'm going to give you management lessons from time to time. Here's a management lesson from you. Four steps. You've got to listen to all four steps, and then your physician understand the complete set. One, if you're a person like me, it's okay to make stuff up, okay? Second, if you do so, say it with confidence, like I'm doing now. None of this shit exists. I'm just making it up. Three, remember what you said. Four, all answers need symmetry. Okay, and let's go back through the example here. Let's presume you're the board of the Partners Healthcare Delivery System. High-level, highfalutin people, mean, too. You just like chomping on people. So you come out and say, Glasser, this project that has been talked about, how much is it going to cost? I don't know. But am I going to say that? No. I say $2.8 million. I made it up. I said it with confidence. Okay? Did you notice how $2.8 million? And I said it with confidence. And I didn't hesitate. You go right for a made-up answer. Now, it's a struggle. I realize it's a mind shift for a number of you, but I want you to, it's really very effective. Now, let's presume 3 months later you're back in front of the board and say, Glasser, that project you talked about 3 months ago, how much did that wind up costing us? And you forgot what you said. So you say $3.2 million. And they say, I thought you said $2.8 million. say, well, we expanded the scope to improve the return. Incredible, I made that up too. Now, let's presume you said 2.4 million. And they said, wait a minute, I thought you said 2.8. We sharpened our pencil, we drove the cost down. See, symmetry, you go either way on the answer on those kinds of stuff. So don't tell them I told you this kind of stuff.
We're recording.
This is true. I'll get you technology guys to deal with it sooner or later. Now, what I'm going to do now is we're going to take an aspect of our strategy and our existence that's got to do with dealing with the payers. Okay, we deal with them all the time. I mean, you show up, you say you're covered by Blue Cross Blue Shield. We need to determine whether you're eligible or not. Are you really covered by them? You're here for your 10th podiatrist visit. We want to know whether your coverage allows 5 or does allow 10. We just want to know what the scope of this thing is. We send claims. At times we're required to get permission for a referral. But there's a lot of transactions that go back and forth, and it's how we get money. It's also a very inefficient process. We have approximately 180 people across partners who deal with claims, just handling them. Harvard Pilgrim has 650 who deal with them, a very inefficient process. So what we try to do, and this is sort of current thinking, is say, well, golly, rather than faxing pieces of paper, making phone calls to determine eligibility or not doing it at all, let's do this electronically. So a transaction, you show up, Brigham and Women's, you say you're Harvard Pilgrim, we pull electronically the Harvard Pilgrim systems and get back an answer. Yes, no, covered or not. And this is an example of work that's been done going on in the region for the last several years, which says I'm over here, Partners Hospital, and I have an eligibility query, and I'm using this thing called the New England Healthcare EDI Network to query the payer systems, whether Harvard Pilgrim or Tufts, or out to Aetna or Cigna or Medicare, Medicaid to get a response. And that's a way, and it's a remarkably efficient way of saving a lot of money, getting a better and faster response to a whole bunch of transactions that go back and forth. So if you go back to financial stability, this is one of the things that you do, is to improve your capture revenue and drive the cost down. And it's remarkable. What it used to cost is on a sort of amortized basis, $2.60 per manual transaction to do this stuff. Now it costs us a dime. So that's unusual to see gains of that magnitude, but nonetheless, that goes on. Now that kind of stuff leads to, unless you're a finance people, you don't need to understand this thing. This is a measure of how well you are doing at collecting your revenue that's owed you by the payers. The smaller numbers, the better. So the Mass General has gone from 105 days, that's sort of the average days outstanding a claim is, to something that's on the order of 90. That's good. I mean, they're making improvement as a result of that thing that I showed you and other things that we're doing here. So there's value going on here. Now, in a pure strategy sense, you've done your job. You know, we had this issue, we put in this technology, we're getting data like this, done. But if you imagine, and this is where we're in the trajectory sense, say, well, fair enough, but what lies beyond this? What's the next step that needs to go this, even if the strategy is silent on this thing? And this came out of a very important analysis we did with Harvard Pilgrim. And we took 1,000 people out of a Brigham outpatient system, you know, and who said they were Harvard Pilgrim members. You go into the database, you know, who's your insurance carrier? It says Harvard Pilgrim. And we compared the ID that we have, your Harvard Pilgrim member number, that ID, and some demographics, you know, white male, 47, that's me, demographics with what Harvard Pilgrim had on their database. You know, what did they have as a subscriber ID, and what did they have as their demographic? And we found that we agreed 87% of the time on what we had. We found that we had them in our database, but they didn't have them in theirs. And that may have been because you changed to Blue Cross Blue Shield, or you left the area. And you're no longer covered by Harvard Pilgrim, but you haven't been back to see us. And so we're out of sync over that. On the other hand, we found 10% where we agreed on the member ID, but not the demographics. And our poster child of this was a woman who we had the same Harvard Pilgrim ID as they had, but we had her spelled as Betsy. They had her spelled as Bitsy. For a vowel, a single vowel. My world turned on a single vowel in this case. Or we both agreed on Betsy, but the digits were off by one or whatever. Now, what happens when this occurs? It's a rejected claim. So we'll launch a claim over, and we have Betsy number one. They compare with number one. They have Betsy, and they say, we reject it. We don't know who you're talking about. You send it back to the Brigham to be resolved. A lot of work on our end to resolve it. often we write it off. We just say, forget about it. You owe us $100, but it's costing us too darn much to get it. Forget about it. You who are Bitsy are Bitsy wondering what's going on here because you keep getting these notices. So terrible service collectively costs us, costs them. This is a problem. So even though we now have that electronic network in place, this problem hasn't gone away. We have inconsistent data between us, and so it hasn't gone away in the next step. So the next stage is saying, well, I want to get rid of this particular problem. And if you begin to actually think about it a little bit longer, and this is a very broad conversation we have with Blue Cross Blue Shield, you say, wait a minute. What this is actually pointing out is that in multiple instances, you have databases, we have databases that are different, but in a way are intended to illustrate the same thing. Betsy, demographics, coverage, this, that, and the other. You happen to have logic that sort of reviews a claim and makes sure that it all lines up, that fraud isn't going on. We actually replicate that logic on our side to make sure the claim's likely to pass or clear or satisfy all the edits before we send it to you. We share common processes. In fact, we have a lot of redundancy between us. So we ought to actually look at getting rid of that redundancy. Now let me give you another example we're talking about. If you're a doctor and you want to practice at our hospitals, we credential you. And that's a process by which we go out and make sure you really do have an MD. And that what you really don't have is a whole lot of mad people because you got malpractice problems out the yin-yang on this kind of stuff. So we're not all that interested in having you hurt our people in addition to all the other people you hurt before. So we credential that stuff. No, we really, because you got to be careful because walk in, I'm an MD, I'm here to treat. I don't know if you, saw the movie, I forget what, Leonardo DiCaprio and, Catch Me If You Can, but, walk in and start masquerading as a doc. Again, saying with confidence, I know what you have. What's that? You have this terrible disease. Oh, my God. So we do that, but so do they. And they do it because they don't want to pay you unless you can sure be certified that you're a doctor. So we both credential. Answer, why don't we share credentialing function, give it to both of us? And as you'll see in this particular example here, and I don't know how, technically, I don't know how we would do this, but rather than have your subscriber database and ours, why don't we sort of synchronize them, maybe even share them, a common database to have this kind of activity here, and to reduce your cost. Now, it's likely, based on some analysis, if you're Harvard Pilgrim and you have 650 people dealing with Mangle claims, we could drop that by an order of magnitude, down to 65. That is a non-trivial gain. These people have, very small margins, how much money they make, and to remove the need for 600-plus people is a serious gain. We're all under collective pressures to keep premiums down. If you're tracking this at all, premiums are up 12%, 15%. You can't keep doing that and have a political environment or an employer environment do that. Yes?
I have a question for you. I've heard a lot of things about improving billing, recovery, but if you do that and you increase revenue, what does it do on the other side in terms of the insurance companies? Are the savings that you're going to receive from HIV actually going to be enough to offset the additional money that they're having to put out to physicians, to hospitals?
Yeah, and we've actually run through the analysis that says based on what we write off and that you'd probably have to pay us and other by the fact that at times those 105 days, that's often the amount of money you have the cash but don't have to pay us. Eventually that you will, so there's a interest on that, that you could be accruing. So when you capture the economic value of float, so to speak, and the value of not having to pay all these $100 things, you still wind up ahead on this kind of stuff. And they're also believing that, at the end of the day, what is, an insurance company, a health insurance company, is becoming a commodity business, that you have to survive on service, like a lot of sort of commodity class businesses here. And the service now is not what they need it to be, so they need to elevate service. But actually, for a while, people believe the float's sufficient to do this kind of stuff. It actually turns out that the economic value of removing 600 people from the payroll is greater than that value. Now, it's helped by the interest rates being terrible these days. If we went up to, things in the 70s, I don't know that it would be at this point.
John, don't you have to do the same thing not only for partners but also for care group and lifespan and everybody else?
Well, this is, I think, Pete, there's a fair question. If it, let's presume it's brilliant, and it really does drop by an order of magnitude. You know, 600 people times a fully loaded cost of $50,000 a shot. I can't do math that big, but whatever. You know, is they say, boy, I work great with a Brigham. Now I got to do it with Care Group, Boston Medical Center, Children's, Leahy, and, you know, all the way down the line. And we're turning around and saying, now we don't have as big a problem because we have to deal with Tufts and Harvard Pilgrim and Medicare and Medicaid. So to really get value, you have to do it at scale. The question then becomes to both of us, and I think step one is let's prove that it has utility. Step two is suppose you can't get 100%, you know, ever. What percent becomes of sufficient interest? And so maybe you don't have to get every hospital, but if you got Care Group, Boston Medical Center, Leahy Clinic, and New England Medical Center, that'd be sufficient to justify you. So going from 650, you go to 300 or some other number. So there's a question of regional scale. So the other example here, too, and I think this is actually technically messier. By the way, I personally chose the colors for these things. I am badly colorblind in a bunch of ways. I'll tell you another story here. As mentioned, this woman who I'm married to, I actually met when I was 19 and she was 18, quite young. Both at Duke as undergraduates. And I was going to impress her. I was going to go out and buy a suit by myself. You know, a cosmopolitan, hip kind of guy. I was going to go out and buy my own suit. So I went out and bought a suit, and I came back and I presented it. I said, you know, Denise, what do you think of this? Now, I'm trying to, you know, impress her that she's going out with some hot. I'm hot. You can tell I'm still hot. I was hot then. But anyway. And she was trying to be nice, too, because she didn't want to. She kind of liked me, so I wasn't going to blow it. Anyway, so I said, what do you think of the suit? And she said, when do you think you'll wear it? I said, well, it's a good-looking brown suit. You know, a fellow like me, suave, debonair, can wear a good-looking brown suit on all kinds of occasions. She said, well, you know, I don't mean to hurt your feelings here, but it's actually bright green. So unless you're planning to be in a St. Patrick's Day parade, I'm not sure you got any chance of wearing this thing. So,
that's why you moved to Boston.
That's why, and that's why, you know, I have, you know, the classic boring corporate attire. I have a blue suit, wingtips, white shirt, and a tie that can go with almost anything. But anyway, using this brilliant color scheme, one of the things that you find is, for example, you can get a claim rejected because there's the lab test and the payer says, I want to know the diagnosis that required this lab test. And the provider enters a diagnosis that is, not, as far as the payer is concerned, unrelated to the lab test. Sometimes it's because we're wrong or whatever, but this thing comes ripping through and gets denied because of that. So there's logic that runs on their side that is subject to the claims. It's actually hundreds of rules. I'm not sure where the count is. But rather than, in the old way now, we send a claim, they run a bunch of rules, and they zip back a whole bunch of things that are rejected. We buy software over here trying to mimic what they have here so that if there is a problem, we catch it early and don't waste the time sending it back and forth. Is to take this rule set and actually have it propagate throughout a range of systems so that as you're ordering on the order entry system or as you're registering someone or you're scheduling someone, this logic is guiding all the way along the way. So shared logic, which is mutually owned and propagated from their end across our systems. Now, this can be challenging because not all of these systems are all that open. I mean, some of them are notoriously difficult because of vendor limitations or whatever to get in place up here. So those two examples are examples where it is outside the immediate strategy-derived response. It is saying, I'm looking at a set of relationships that we will have for the rest of time, and I need to understand where will they be going and how will I respond to them. In a way, it's kind of interesting. If you look at retail, let's take Walmart and Procter & Gamble, for example. Walmart and Procter & Gamble and Walmart and any one of the people who supply stuff to, you know, Walmart shelves has a dual relationship. In this case, they beat the crap out of each other. You know, Walmart's hammering Procter & Gamble to drive the prices down. Make it lower so we can promote low-cost specials. Procter & Gamble beats on Walmart because they want to keep the prices as high as they can get them, but also want more shelf space, you know, so that as you walk through toothpaste, all you see is Procter & Gamble products in this stuff. So there's a very antagonistic relationship. We have that with the payers. You know, how much are you going to pay our doctors? It's too low. We want to raise it, et cetera. They also have, interesting enough, a very collaborative relationship in which they blend supply chains. And so they make sure that people are aware of, and Procter & Gamble, what's selling, what's not selling, reduce inventory costs, et cetera. What's going on here is that healthcare has traditionally always been this antagonistic. Every 3 years, we beat the hell out of each other with great regularity. Starting in the fall, we'll start beating up on Harvard Pilgrim all over again. is to begin to develop a collaborative stuff, which is to move us in a line along the lines of that. And that's complicated. Complicated governance issues, complicated who's in charge issues, complicated technology choices, there are privacy issues that ripple through this, et cetera. Now that, so that's an example here, and there are other examples here. This, what we're going to do here is essentially take a look at six classes of applications that we have at Partners, and this is a technology lens. So we're and largely expressed at an application level. We're going to go through them and then why. So what I have to do and to be responsible is if we're going to go off and spend $1 gazillion, let's take provider order entry. And for those who don't know what this is where the physician or the nurse, but largely the physician, enters an order into the computer system, and the computer system comes back and critiques it. Says, you know, smart move, not so smart move, or borderline smart move. And then has transmits it to the lab or the pharmacy where the work is carried out, et cetera. So and it's very expensive. And also requires that you you change the habits of 7,000 physicians to sort of writing on paper to using the screen, which is a difficult change exercise. So why would you do this? This becomes type of an exercise. You will also know as we go through these related to core processes. Now, let me give you an example of why you would do this kind of stuff, and we'll see data here. As I mentioned before, 15,000 people will show up at a Partners facility today to see a doctor, outpatient care, again, hospital clinics, et cetera. We know for every 100 who show up today, 5.5 are here because of an adverse drug event related to a prescribed medication. Their doctor gave them something that is hurting them. It isn't helping them, and it's hurting them. And at times, it is seriously hurting them. So every 1,000 people who walk in today, we will admit 3.4 into the hospital. Harm is that bad, you have to be in the hospital. So just to put a little into play here, today, if today is an average day, 45 people will be admitted because the drug their doctor giving them is hurting them so enough that they have to be put into the hospital. It's a remarkable number. You'll see some of these other statistics here. For every 1,000 prescriptions that people write on paper, et cetera, 40 are medically wrong. The dose doesn't exist. You wouldn't give it that route, or it's too high, et cetera. So when you get in and you say, why am I going to spend an amazing amount of money to do this, one needs sort of an analysis and value type of stuff. So we're going to walk through a little bit of each of these things, say, what are they, and then why do you worry about these things? I am a huge fan of numbers, and I particularly love numbers that point out value and why these things are useful and what the gains would be. So these are technology-centric about why would you adopt these kinds of things. Those of you who don't know what an order entry system looks like, now you can tell your friends and your family that you've seen a screenshot of it. They will be suitably impressed. This is what they look like. So I'm entering someone's entering an order for a drug called Coumadin, which is a blood-thinning agent. This is a thing that you prescribe when you want to avoid clotting or reduce the likelihood of clotting. And it runs through the various form of tell me about the dose, how you want it, you know, number of tablets, when do you want to start, frequency, how many times you take it in a day, things like that, and any particular comments. So the physician enters this on a particular basis. And some logic in the background, fairly simple, and if you look at the Boolean expression of this stuff, it isn't that complicated of all set of logic. It can be medically complicated about the content of the rule, but it comes back, and this is a contrived example as an example, pointing out an allergy that you've ordered whatever that drug is there, and that is related to another drug for which there is a fairly serious allergy here. So subjecting it to logic, drug-drug interactions, drug-allergy interactions. It can be drug-lab interactions. If you have low blood potassium levels, some drugs cause the potassium level to drop even further, which can lead to arrhythmias, erratic beating of the heart, for example. We found in a particular study that 25% of the people discharged from the Brigham and Women's Hospital with an antibiotic. So you take all the people with an antibiotic, walking out the door with a prescription for an antibiotic. 25% of them were given an antibiotic prescription, which would have no effect given the microorganism culture results. So if they got better, it wasn't because of the prescription. It was because of chicken soup and the love of their mother or whatever it happened to be that was going on here. Now, when you do that, and you have to imagine that an order like this in the hospital goes on approximately 12,000 times a day at a place like the Brigham. So it's not a small number. In the outpatient setting, if you take those 15,000 people who walk in, 70% of them will get a prescription. And we're not clear whether they all need prescriptions or whether you don't feel like you were really listening to the doc unless they write you a prescription. Because, one, it points out that you were sick. Otherwise, you wouldn't be getting a prescription. The second, it shows that they actually exerted medical knowledge and this stuff. So there's a complicated effect going on there, too. One of the things that you find, if you do that, is that the rate of medication errors, which are serious, in other words, there are three classes, rough classes of medication errors. There are those that are fatal. This is not good. There are those that are life-threatening, where actually you were at peril for a period of time, and those are serious. Definition of serious is you were in the day in a hospital an additional day, or there is a permanent disability, which is the definition of serious. But we drop the rate through various checking by 55%, which is a substantive gain in the number of times that these things are occurring. Now, in addition to that kind of stuff, not all of the stuff we do, like that example, might peril. One is if you order an H2 blocker, I don't know what H2 blockers do. All I know is they fail the spell check on this stuff. But nizatidine does, is that if you're the people responsible for drugs in the hospital, there's a group called generally Pharmacy and Therapeutics Committee, which looks at what drugs should we allow people to prescribe and which not, is they looked at oral H2 blockers as a class of drug and said the one we like the best is nizatidine. And so this is, if you're going to order that, we would prefer that you do that. So up comes your order for an H2 blocker other than nizatidine. The computer says we'd like to shift you to this particular drug. And you can see that the shift led to a remarkable improvement in the people picking the, quote, preferred drug here. This is actually one of my favorites, which says, the computer comes back and says, dose is too high. And this can be, most of the time you worry about this is a chemotherapeutic agent, which is, can be very devastating drugs. And it was dropped by factor 3, just pointing out that the dose is too high. Now, at times that's to indicate, your weight, whether you're a kid and things like that. This is a drug that, if you're on chemotherapy, curbs nausea. And people were ordering it 4 times daily. And if you do it 3 times daily, you have the same therapeutic effect. So if you order ondansetron, it defaulted to 3 times daily. And in the sense, you had the same equivalent effect, it just cost less by doing it, not rather than 4 or 3 times. And the frequency shift went from 6 to 75%. And then last but not least, if you order bed rest, so I want you to sit in bed for a while, you're at some risk of developing clots. And so we'd like to order a blood thinning agent to reduce the likelihood that you develop clots that go on here. So you can use it to guide behavior. On average, 3% of all orders get changed by a physician based on a computer suggestion. Now, not this breathtaking percentage, but 3% of 12,000 is a very big number. It's 350, 400 times a day the computer guides someone to a different place because of the suggestions that are going on here. So one extra, if you said, I'm coming in through the technology lens, I want to come in through order entry, why would I do this? And largely because you can guide behavior. Now, it is, let me see this in a little bit here. It is inconceivable to me that a physician, and some of you, I suspect, are physicians, actually master the domain of medicine. If you're at the Brigham and Women's Hospital, you order 3,000 medications. You can order 1,100 lab tests. You can order 300 radiology procedures. If you look at the International Classification of Disease, broadly, there are about 10,000 symptoms or syndromes, problems, diseases, et cetera. You can't master all that. Now, if you're a neurologist, we're not expecting you to master everything, but you can't master this domain. Some work done at New England Medical Center by a guy named Steve Parker about 20 years ago said the average primary care doc has to know 1 million facts. The average specialist has to know 2 million facts. I counted, I know 35, and 6 of them are recorded on my driver's license, so I can refresh them on any given day. You can't master that. I don't care how smart you are, you can't master that. And similarly, even if you did, and you guys are smart people, suppose you did, if anybody's capable, you all are, how long would that knowledge remain good? And the answer is in a very short period of time. So on an annual basis, 460,000 articles are added to the refereed biomedical literature. And again, they're not all replying to your domain, but an exceptionally volatile knowledge. So here what we're doing is applying logic surrounding this transaction. This is, we're going to try to help you out because you're a human being. And you're going to be, even if you're smart, you can be tired and make a mistake, et cetera. So you look at order entry and why does this. It also points out, if we go back to a process, if you were to ask me this, of all the things that go on in a care setting, what is the single most important process that exists? You can only fix one, and the answer is the process by which the physician arrives at a decision about what to do. You know, what am I going to prescribe or not prescribe? What procedure do I need or test, et cetera? That drives approximately 80% of the aggregate cost of care and accounts for 60% of mistakes. That decision at that moment, and that's the one to go after in a lot of ways. Next one I'm going to show you here is the computerized medical record. This is what they look like. They all look the same. And here we have our patient blanked out because we're, Pete and I are now privacy conscious kind of guys, plus the law in April 14th, HIPAA, the big privacy law, will kick into here. And that lists their medications, the problems that they have. Actually, it's interesting at the VA, looking at the problem list of the typical veteran. Holy chamoles, massive amounts of diabetes, coronary artery disease, and substance abuse issues. So very stunning. Procedures that have gone on in allergies, and then problems. So here's the reminder that says, patient has coronary artery disease, and you haven't given them aspirin, which just helps with reducing the inflammation that goes on. So we're going to recommend that you provide aspirin. Patient is needs an overdue for a mammogram. I'm not sure what the age is here, but just to remind you to do a certain set of things. Now there are in the provider sector two system implementations which are quote a bitch. I mean, they are just really, really hard. One is ordering because of how often it goes on, how little time physicians have, et cetera. So the average time to enter a order in the Brigham and Women's Hospital is 90 seconds, which is approximately 45 seconds too long. It just goes on all the time and very serious time pressures on this thing. This is the other, which is to replace paper charts with this record. Very invasive to the workflow, very difficult to get people to adopt once they get over the curve. Let's presume you're a room full of doctors and you're thinking about computerizing the record. Here's what I'm going to tell you the deal is. We have this fancy-dancy computerized record. It's pretty fancy-dancy, and it does all kinds of wonderful things. Here's the deal. It's going to cost you, and remember, these folks are, half the physicians in this country are in solo practice or small group practice. They're small business people. They don't make, they make a reasonable amount of money, but they're small business people. It's going to cost you about $10,000 to $15,000 a year for this record. That's roughly the cost, you amortize everything, et cetera. Now, your way of thinking about that is I got a kid in college, I got a mortgage, so I'm now down $10,000 to $15,000 in my ability to do it. Very direct, very simple way of looking at this stuff. So in addition to reducing your take-home pay, so let's get point number one down. This is going to be right in the middle of the day-to-day activity of your practice. It's very disruptive. So best we can tell, you'll endure a six-month period of time in which you'll suffer approximately a 20% productivity hit. You'll be able to see 20% fewer patients. And you're thinking, wait a minute, that's a further hit on my income because that means my income's dropping by, but you'll recover. Terrific. At the tail end of this thing, and say, well, let's presume I tolerate this, first of all, initial hit of 10 to 15, and then tolerate for a period of 6 months and a further 20. So you're talking about being down a third for a period of time. What's on the other side of this thing? Talk to me about what the value, am I going to make more money in this thing? And the answer is, may not be true, but you'll deliver better care. And this is a very difficult conversation. So it's hard as a change exercise. It's hard of why you would do it exercise. But nonetheless, here's why, some of which we have mentioned. This is data done by a group led by a gentleman named David Bates over at the Brigham and Women's Hospital. He uses a very pronounced and very effective.
He's going to come talk in about 3 weeks.
Oh, cool. David's a smart guy. His group has done this kind of stuff, and he may or may not repeat some of this stuff. But outpatient care is awful. I mean, it's stunning to me. A lot of these are Brigham places, and so you got great doctors and great organizations working really hard and who believe in their bowel of bowels that this is important. Nonetheless, we talked about the adverse drug event rates, and this is where we just not the overall drug adverse drug event, but the life-threatening or serious category, which is the smaller. People who may or may not be having an adverse drug event, but they believe something's wrong. So they're calling back in, or they're worried that nothing's happening, or I felt ill, or I'm worried about this, that, and the other. This is the one that actually bothers me the most of all the data that we have. If you're a woman and you have a marginally abnormal mammogram or pap smear, and what that means is you're not in the zone called clean bill of health, nor are you in the zone where, holy smokes, there's a mass, we've got to do something, but it ain't quite normal. marginally abnormal, we got to watch it. So it's all known that in those cases, 6 months later, a follow-up exam needs to occur just to make sure you're not heading in a bad direction. And that's what we ought to be doing here. Question, what percent of the time is there no evidence that follow-up occurs? You see the answer. It's about a third of the time. There's no evidence that we repeated the exam, that we talked to the woman. The woman's got the right to say no, but that we even did that kind of stuff. You pull cases, and obviously some of these turn into bona fide cervical cancer or bona fide breast cancer in people who died decades before they should have here. For 1,000 referrals, I send my patient to Dr. Pete here. Dr. Pete is a cardiologist or an endocrinologist or neurologist. 4 weeks later, I haven't heard from him anything. What happened? Beats the hell out of me what happened. Now, in terms of my ability to continue, this is not useful for me to not know whether we got big issues or non-issues, et cetera. Second, you're diabetic, for example, you're at high risk of high cholesterol levels. And, those of you who have high cholesterol, every one of you should be measuring your cholesterol levels, particularly if you're an old guy like me. You ought to be doing that kind of stuff because you feel fine until you stroke is sort of the way we put it, et cetera. So you ought to be measuring it, taking the drugs, et cetera. We know the risk is high. So at a minimum, we ought to be checking your cholesterol levels. It's pretty darn easy to do. The only hard part is you got to fast the night before, which is a pain in the butt. You can't have coffee first thing in the morning. But for 38%, we haven't measured any cholesterol level in the last 3 years. So the reason you go after these kinds of systems is to go after that. Now, you're still in this room full of docs and say, I appreciate all that, but talk to me about this income challenge. And I say, here's what we're going to do with payers in a large way. We're going to move it to such that your payment is based on how well you do on these criteria. A third of your income is going to be based on this kind of stuff. So we'll move you to where the income comes through here. So this is an example of a computerized record and why you would do this kind of stuff because of the magnitude of the problem that goes on. And there is some data that shows that it's actually worthwhile. Let's see if we got the next one, too. If we're able to affect what we want to affect, these are your costs. Actually, the partner's costs are lower than what you can get out in the commercial setting. So we're cheap. And that's because we turn it off every other day. But nonetheless, we're relatively expensive. This is the dollar value that you might see to your practice. This is the low end where there's sort of low payment for quality. This is the high end where there's high payment for quality. And this is how it sort of breaks out. About 10% is because of you save money. You don't have to pull the record. So if I call into my doctor and say, Doc, I got a question about the drug. The doctor says, oh my God, I've got 2,000 patients. I don't remember what I gave you. Is rather than pull the chart, I can bring it up on the computer screen and save the cost. People do this. I transcribe, I dictate, I saw John Glass, the following is working or not working, et cetera. I have to pay for that transcription service, and now I can use structured text and other things like this. The other is by doing better documenting of these billing, ignoring that other conversation, I'm likely to get paid better. Because if I write the wrong diagnosis, I don't get paid. They deny the claim, et cetera. So I might make more revenue. But we believe that your adverse drug events ought to decrease, and hence you get paid for that. That you, by prescribing drugs that do the same thing but don't cost as much as an alternative, that you can actually save money and do a better job on things like this. If you look at expensive radiology procedures, MRI, CT, stuff like that, approximately 15% of the orders that a physician will place in the outpatient setting are for the wrong modality. So, for example, if the doc said you might have appendicitis, I need to determine whether you have appendicitis, and I order a KUB, which is a radiology procedure. They flood you with dye, take pictures and stuff like that. The computer will come back and say, wrong procedure. That's unlikely to tell you what you're interested in learning. You ought to be doing the ultrasound instead. So guiding people to the right radiology procedure, et cetera, is part of this. Third example here is knowledge. And this is an example of what we do. Most places do this kind of stuff, is a extranet of some form. Allows you to search the literature, pull up licensed textbooks, junk like that, go through a bazillion journals and pull up either the abstracts or the entire text. And then there are some other internally developed and externally developed knowledge resources is what we call it. You can go to these, and it's like being in an electronic library. About 1,000 times a day, someone will go after this kind of stuff. Here's an example, guidelines for screening cervical cancer. This actually goes back, it's sort of rough forms of disease management, where you publish the best approaches. So how often people survey the literature, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists and other sources, and say, what's the right way to screen? How often should you do this kind of stuff? Now, some of this I've mentioned before, I guess all of this I've mentioned before, is the reason you do this is because of the sheer difficulty of knowing and managing all of this activity. Question, does it work? This is a harder one to get a handle on, the delivery of knowledge, at least in this vein here. This is data where we have a lot of docs out in the community. They're not at the academic health centers. They're out in a small office in Needham or a small office in Cambridge or wherever. And we extended this thing called Teaching Net, which is an extra net that we extended out to them. And before this went out, we asked, if you have a question about a patient, where do you go to get an answer? And so these are not mutually exclusive categories, but I might go to a book, I might go to a journal, I might talk to one of my other colleagues in the practice, I might go to a fellow cardiologist at a different practice in Peachy, or I might use a computer, and in this case more of the Medline activity here, and ask the same question after the fact, after this thing. And obviously there's a shift to using the computer. That is, you know, our vetting of the knowledge has resulted in a perceived easier to get to, more efficient to get to set of knowledge. So we see shifts there, although I don't know that the decisions are any better as a result of this stuff. This is a result of some work where we gave to the medical staff at the Brigham a PDA with Hippocrates. So those who don't know what Hippocrates is, a set of licensed material of physician desperate, you know, be able to look up drugs, look up information about diseases, et cetera. And this is self-reporting on this thing. This is a product called QRX. And they found, you know, you look at the data and you find they like it. And it's useful. You've got to be a little careful with these kind of numbers because you're not really sure whether they prevented or didn't prevent an adverse drug event. But nonetheless, delivering knowledge in that kind of passive form is viewed as a reasonably useful thing to do. The thing that we did now, or at least something a little bit more recently, here we're now, we're in this gauge, and this is an example here where I am a patient in another part of the States or anywhere on the globe, and I want a second opinion from a doctor's, a partner's doctor. So I could be in Beijing, I could be in Dallas, I could be in the Middle East. I have been diagnosed with cancer, I've exhausted or think I've exhausted the local care team, and I want a second opinion, and I'm going to get it from an oncologist at Dana-Farber using this technology. So I'm coming through globally through the internet to do this kind of stuff. So this is what we're going to talk about now and just give you an example of doing this thing. Now, also going to point to, you know, those of you who are curious about what someone, you know, sort of go back to some of the earlier comments, about, you know, sort of what does a person like me do for a living? And it's, you know, a remarkably cool existence. I go to meetings for a living. I mean, fundamentally, I go to meetings and I either make stuff up or deliver insightful comments. I got to do one or the other every other meeting. And I do this 14 hours a day. This is the sort of life that I have. I get free coffee. I get cookies. I get free pencils. I don't have to sweat. I don't get my hands dirty. The likelihood that I'm going to get my limb removed, I might get my psyche destroyed, but I'm not going to get my limb removed on any given day. Now, when you get into a conversation, and this is sort of where we go back to, you know, sort of strategy and support thing, and you're coming in on a technology vector, is you say, and actually we'll sort of rewind the videotape in sort of the internet heyday of a couple of years ago, and all the buzz, and you guys were perhaps there. I'm certainly going to be working longer than I had planned to because of the collapse of my investments that followed all that kind of stuff. You say, what does the internet fundamentally do? And this is how you sort of arrive at this thing. Fundamentally, it does two things. It extends range. You know, it allows you to take a service and remarkably increase the range. You can, you know, I don't have to worry about your workstation. I don't have to worry about your locale. You could be in Beijing. You could be in Brazil. You could be Seoul, North Korea. You could be Frankfurt, Germany. It's trivial. Becomes trivial for me to extend the range of a service at a level. I mean, in some services, you can't extend that way. I mean, if you're a woman who's pregnant, extending pregnancy services like that is silly because you actually have to touch and see and something. But some services you can extend in the range. The other is that you can increase the efficiency of richness. And what does that mean? Let's presume I'm a doctor, I'm a primary care provider. What would be really a terrific experience if I had in the back room a dermatologist, neurologist, cardiologist, oncologist waiting for me to come back and say, hey, yo, dermatologist, come on out here. I want you to take a look at this skin. Beats the hell out of me with the solda. And they're all playing cards until I come and summon them. Now, that's a very rich care experience because you can bring this diverse set of knowledge to the care scene. But obviously that doesn't work because if nothing else, nobody likes to play cards that long. And it's just very expensive to do. So how is it that I get to that level of expertise efficiently? And the interview becomes a way to deliver a rich experience very efficiently because you can extend access to a specialist or this, that, or the other in a much more efficient fashion. So if you say, all right, two fundamental axes that I have or sort of dimensions to apply to what the internet can do to me. Next question, for us, given what we do, where is it that that might matter? That both the range extension or efficiency gain of richness is a material contribution to what we're all about. And this becomes one of the areas. Say, son of a gun, I can take world-class specialists. We got a lot of specialists, 4,000 out of the 7,000. You want a specialist, we got them. And I can take that specialist, which is an extraordinary asset that we have. It's fundamentally why they're great hospitals, because they have world-class specialists, and extend their range. They don't have to worry about whether you can physically get here or whether you live in Newton. They can extend their range. Second is I can deliver their experience very efficiently to people across the globe in that way. So of all the areas that came out of the internet, this was one of the more interesting ideas because it leveraged those two fundamental aspects. So walking through that chain of logic of some fundamental concepts and some fundamental precepts that guide us. Let me give you another example of a fundamental concept and precept. Having spent, as I think I mentioned, a day at Kaiser Permanente, Northern California, Monday, Intermountain Healthcare on Salt Lake on Tuesday, and VA yesterday, all using the computerized record to improve quality of care. There's almost a crusade to move this thing across the board. Why? Conceptually, why is the record? Above and beyond those numbers, conceptually, what's going on here? Four things. One is that you have the ability to capture structured information and make it accessible. That you can enter in not just this, pieces of paper floating around and, blobs of narrative, but I can structure diagnosis, lab tests, and this, that, and I can then analyze, et cetera. But that's sort of point number one. Point number two is in the course of treating people, and you saw some examples, I can remind you to do things. You got a bazillion patients. You're not going to remember that it's time for the mammogram, et cetera. I can remind you to do things. Third, you saw examples there, is I can critique a transaction, a referral transaction. It's time to send the guy the note. You saw him last week, Pete, you saw him last week, send the note back to them, or say this order is the wrong order, et cetera. The fourth is that it enables you to aggregate the data, roll it up, and look at practices across the board. So part of it is conceptually trying to understand what the basic parameters are, ways that you do this kind of thing are here. So in this case, say, all right, I got concepts, I got an area. Let's deliver second opinions across the board. Interesting idea. Next discussion, you get into all kinds of is it covered by malpractice? What are the licensure issues, et cetera? No one will pay for this. It's not, if you send in your bill to your payer saying, I was seen by a telemedicine person in San Francisco, and they charged me $500, pay me for it, they'll laugh. So it's not a reimbursable service. So you run this thing through, and you pilot it, and you learn it. And I think we have an example of the gains that were learned here. Yeah. Unbelievable. A small sample. You've got to be a little bit careful about this stuff. Largely in oncology. So if you look at the cases that went on, the doctor at Partners changed the diagnosis 1 out of 16 times. That is a phenomenal number to actually change what is seen as wrong with you. And so you can actually do a very fundamental shift. Even where we agreed with the diagnosis, and we had people make sure that these were material changes, the care plan changed 85%, or we changed the chemotherapy regime in a material fashion, or we changed radiation therapy suggestions. So I'm going to presume, and we will do analysis later, that the doctor is right, that we didn't change a good diagnosis to a crummy diagnosis or a good treatment plan to a crummy treatment plan, but there's obviously gain here. So now we actually walk through is that, all right, I've done this thing. It has some conceptual appeal. We put it out there, you do all the software development, you deal with lawyers and attorneys about malpractice issues and licensure issues and a bunch of other stuff, and now you've analyzed it. What's become now, it's kind of interesting to me, is that we have a conversation which is due to close shortly with General Electric. And General Electric will offer it to all employees as an employee benefit. You know, so and then you think about why would General Electric do this? You know, this isn't free. It costs about $500 per. So, you know, why would they do this? Two reasons. They have 100 plants in the U.S., 100 plants globally, all of which have a plant doctor to deal with the employees of the plant. Plant doctor every now and then says, beats me what's going on here, but I'd like an answer. So I'm going to actually get on this thing, consult with my colleagues back at the Mass General to get an answer. So they see it as a way of extending specialists to help 200 primary doctors out in the plants deal with stuff. Those of you familiar with GE, Six Sigma, hate variation, I mean, with a passion, hate variation. So this is a way of reducing the variability of specialty care. As you narrow down who you're going to deal with and you have them follow protocols, et cetera. There are three other conversations with Fortune 50 employers to do the same thing. So this thing now actually moves out and is a strategy sense into a actual bona fide service that makes money, in addition to helping a whole bunch of other folks do this kind of stuff. Points to an aspect of sort of left the main tread of the tracks, but that's okay. You guys didn't notice it anyway. When you look at strategy and IT stuff, and one of the things is those of you who spend any time, if you wind up taking MIS courses, God forbid you want a job like I have, is that you often view that it's sort of this normative derivation process. Tell me your goals, I'll derive the strategy. You know, and that's how it works. And so I go to, I go to all these meetings, listen to all these muckety mucks, chief medical officers talk about plans and strategies, and I say, aha, I'm going to derive an IT plan for you, and we'll bounce it off, and away we go. It's the core of it, but it's not all of it, because part of what you have to see, and this is a terrific example, this is part of no strategy out of parts. Nobody said, we got to extend the reach and the range of our services. We got to really go after the efficiency of richness experience leveraging our specialists. Nobody says that. Is looking at technology and recognizing an asset and knowing how to move things through a conceptual structure that's sufficient to a prototype, to an actual reality of things like that. So part of what we wind up doing is trying things to see whether they have particular appeal or particular utility. Next example here is Patient Gateway. This is a set of software by which I, the patient, interact with you, the doctor, asking questions, requesting prescription refills and a bunch of other stuff. It is an example of there are three classes, if you're dealing with patients, as a provider, three classes of apparatus like this. One is the class that is destined largely for people who are relatively well, people like me, who are, I don't have any major ailments, but relatively well. Also, my general theory is that most men, even if they're not relatively well, won't acknowledge that, that they will persist in the belief that they're sort of 12 morals forever. I actually have this theory when sort of semi-religious. I actually went to Jesuit high school, and I was kicked out in the middle of my junior year for publishing an underground newspaper, which sort of pissed me off. The Catholic Church pissed me off at that point, so I haven't really been back to them ever since. But nonetheless, I have this belief that when God created man and woman, said, cool, I like this species. Well, I can mind having this around here. I need to have them propagate, and I need to entrust one of them with the propagation of the species. Looked at men and said, not a chance. That's one generation is all I'm getting out of you, and women are much more responsible on this front. So, but nonetheless, this is a way of channeling your doctor for routine stuff. Second, so this is relatively well people, basic transactions, ATM-like, although not ATM in frequency, because I don't interact with my physician all that often. There's a second category, which we won't have an example here, is people who are chronically ill. And often, the chronic disease, if you're intelligent about it, is not going to kill you. That's not strictly true. But what's often needed is a lot of ongoing interest in new trials, new drugs, new diseases, and often a lot of interest in community. So we have a site over at the Mass General for people who are epileptic. There's nothing that we know of that's going to cure epilepsy at this moment. And often what you see in the course of this is community. It's heart-wrenching, too. Remember one interchange, getting to see an interchange, where one guy said, I finally got on a date. I haven't been on a date in a long time. What do I do to make sure I don't seize during the day? Oh, my God. Realize that that was the issue. So there's a class of stuff often directed for the chronically ill for which immediate tanking is not the issue. And then there's a class for the medically fragile. Now, people who you do worry about are essentially is sort of an extended care facility out in their home the system here. So this is a thing that we have. The people at Care Group, and I guess John will be here, Hoampa will be here, have done perhaps the best work in the region on this kind of stuff, is extending this out and about. Why would you do this? Actually, I think the best data comes out of Kaiser Permanente at this point. Kaiser Permanente, and this is actually several years old, had a thing called KP Online, which allowed you can see what it did. Ask a question, review guidelines, consumer information, and review your benefits and do some basic stuff. And they did it with 100,000 members. They have, 8 million people they cover in aggregate across Kaiser. Absolutely remarkable stuff. 11% fewer office visits. But I didn't need to come and see the doctors. I got my question answered over this thing. They treated, 46% fewer phone calls. I didn't have to call the nurse. Now, for Kaiser, which is also a provider and an insurance company, this is terrific because this is less expense, and hence their insurance premiums can go down here. You ask a bunch of partners, doctors, say, wait a minute, 11%, that's a drop in income. You're already hitting me for 15%, then you're going up another 20%, now you have another 11%. Love guys like you, John. How do they make guys like you? And you're still employed by us. This is remarkable. Wait a minute, this is income. And I'm not happy. You already cut my income in half. Say, well, here's the deal. At least there's the theory of the deal. We have yet to prove that this is the deal. A lot of what happens when these folks come in is that it's a fairly routine office visit that doesn't require much testing. It requires looking at you and saying, you're okay, go home. Now, there's sufficient demand that for every person like that who doesn't come in, there's someone who does come in who needs blood work, radiology procedures, and a much more intense experience. To be crass about it, those are more lucrative. So you're actually likely to backfill with people who are more lucrative. The other thing you have to be careful of is that for a physician, there's a thing called churn, which is expensive. In other words, most physicians have, if you're a good doctor, 5% of your patients will leave you every year and go off to some other doctor for whatever set of reasons. And that's if you're a good doctor. If you're an okay doctor, it's more like 10%. That's expensive to you. Why is that expensive to you? Because when the first patient comes in, what do they generally want? I want the soup to nuts, nose to toes assessment here, doc. How much am I going to get paid for the soup to nuts, nose to toes? Not enough to cover the expense of delivering that kind of stuff. So churn matters. To the degree people believe this is great service and don't churn on you, this actually has reward here. These are remarkable. For Kaiser, which is an insurance company, they have an enrollment cost too. That this, the elevated perceptions of Kaiser. So I think a number of folks. We have some grant activity along these lines. I don't know. We covered this thing. Are beginning to study the impact of these things and to see how important and what the value of this might be. This is an example, although a sort of crappy-ass chart, of congestive heart failure. So in this way, I've captured whether you've automatically entered it or we take it off some piece of gizmos, your pulse, your blood pressure, your oxygen saturation, and your weight. Because this is the third category, medically fragile. And then we can graph it to you for you to show you that you're doing a good job. Why would you do this? Great data out of Mercy General. These are folks in Sacramento, California, and a thing called Health Buddy for congestive heart failure. Those of your physicians know that generally what happens when a deterioration of congestive heart failure patient is day one, you feel okay, if you're sort of sliding. Day three, you're beginning to be worried, now discernible, and then day four, day five, you wind up in the hospital or something bad happens. But it's clear day one what's going on here. You just don't feel it here. So this is a way of where reporting of status, there's an analysis of condition, and then a way of exchanging messages back and forth. They dropped the nurse caseload. How many patients can a nurse take care of? They doubled it, largely because I can deal with you electronically rather than having to go out to see you and to drive out to see you. I'm not off the hook for doing that, but I can do that less frequently. The other thing is between changes in symptoms and actual care went from 5 days down to one. So the deterioration is detected much more quickly, which leads to a decrease, non-trivial decrease in the cost. Sooner or later, if you have congestive heart failure, you're going to wind up back in the hospital. You're very sick. But you can see that the cost to treat you is a lot lower because we catch it earlier or remit it a lot sooner here. And then this, I think we're rounding on the horn here, and I need to, maybe I'll stop after this one. We'll ask some questions here. This is the last slide here. I love this chart. Now, what this chart is if this shows you healthcare in some ways the worst. These are 11 clinics in Boston. And what was done by a group of folks out of the Brigham, led by a guy named Troy Brennan, was to assess them based on HEDIS. If you don't know what HEDIS is, it's essentially how well you do routine managed maintenance of care, how often you do the mammograms, cholesterol checks, et cetera. This is patient satisfaction with their doctor. Are they nice? They explain stuff and stuff like that. Clinic function, satisfaction with the clinic. In other words, can I get an appointment when I want? Do they make me wait too long? These are the important ones. How well does when they treat asthmatics, do they comply with good asthma guidelines? How well, when they treat diabetics, do they follow good diabetes guidelines? This is the average score of all 11. So you get these guys over here, site 7. They are great at diabetes. They suck at asthma. These other guys over here, let's see if we can find some, again, you bear with me, that colorblind stuff. But anyway, you'll find other things where it's reversed. I don't know what these colors are. But actually, I remember going to Canada. Goddamn Canadians. You know, I get it with the stoplights, top is red, bottom is green. I get it. Turn it sideways, man. Don't goof with me, okay? Colors are positional, and I got nothing to do with spectrum. But the point being is that this is unacceptable variability of care. Now, no one would find treatment of mechanics or TV repair or any other basic service. This is basic service to allow this kind of variability here. If you have diabetes or asthma, or a member of your family does, you want very much to know the names of these places, because there's some places you're going to go to and some places you're going to avoid like a hawk. So a lot of our challenge in a lot of these systems is to get, first of all, this bar up, because mean doesn't mean it's necessarily the best, but also to get this variability down. And part of the consumer movement means that this stuff will actually start getting published. And those of people who are awful will start being punished as a result of that. I'm going to stop here. I don't know that there's anything. Yeah, we'll just stop here. Questions, comments?
Yeah. You speak about processes and being a CIO, and the average lifespan you said was 3.2 years, and you've been there for a little longer. So what, try not to be humble though, what makes you different from other people who have not been successful?
I curl under my desk in a fetal position and pretend I'm not there. No, works. I think if you're going to be really good, you have a couple things that you do. One is if you're going to survive for a long period of time, you need to have pretty damn good political skill. And it's funny at times. This is a political jungle at times. Sometimes it's a fun contest. Sometimes it's anything but a fun contest. And it's full of symbolism, at times maneuvering, et cetera. I think there's unhealthy politics. There's a politics called normal organization politics, just the way it is. So you better be a very good political actor. The second is that you have to be able to take complicated ideas and be very articulate and clear about them. So I actually think one of the great trainings for CIOs is to teach, because you have to convey to someone, and you're bored, you got 15 minutes of the board, you're asking for $170 million, and you better explain why in 15 minutes. Now, maybe they'll give you 30, but to be very clear about why this, why 10%, and why it all makes sense, et cetera. So you have to be very clear, very articulate. The second is that one of the reasons that I'm good is that the people who work for me are exceptional. And so there is a phenomenon called being very good at judging and assessing talent. And talent comes with awards, but nonetheless, Jesus, you are a gift. I'll give you an example. One of the women who we've hired seven years ago, in the course of an interview, I asked her, what was her favorite book? And she said, a Robert Ludlum novel. You gotta be kidding. Oh, really? What was it about the Robert Ludlum novel that made it your favorite book? She said, I read it when I was 11 and it made me feel like such an adult. I thought, man, you've got insight. You know yourself. For God's sake. So be very good at talent identification, knowing where their warts are and compensating for that, and how to energize them and point them in. They have to be handled differently. Different people have different needs in that way. So identifying and keeping them energized and knowing where their heads are and how to move. I actually fundamentally think women, by and large, are better managers than men, because there's two levels at which you interact with someone. A task level, we need to do A, B, and C, and then a where's your head level. We need a connection here of some form, because I need to know emotionally where you are, what you're worried about, whether you're angry, whether you're giddy, or whatever it happens to be. And I think that's actually an easier connection for most women to form than for most men to form. You have to be very, very good at that. I think at places like Partners, which is about as complex an organization as fundamentally exists. I used to be an organization theorist in graduate school. Partners is at the far right of complexity of scale. So you have to have terrific strategic and conceptual skills to sort of distill complexity to three or four factors and things along those lines. So I think, at the end of the day, plus you have to have an IQ roughly equivalent to the people you're working with. If they don't think you're up there soaring with the eagles, you're getting a lot of trouble and stuff. So it's a combination of good political actor, ability to be articulate about complicated topics, to know how to pick people and keep them psyched and pointed in the right direction, and the ability to frame things well for them. These are the four concepts, the four principles, the five and six, or this follows that, et cetera, that needs to go on there. I also think it helps in all of the above to have passion about what you're doing. Why do I do what I do? Because at the end of the day, I look at those numbers like failure to follow up on abnormal mammograms. You got to be shitting me. that's wrong. And we're going to go fix it. We're not going to make it zero. I don't think that's possible, but we're going to go do it. And at the end of the day, we know that women's care in that case will be a hell of a lot better, and that's why we're here. And if you have that kind of sort of passion, it infects in all kinds of ways, that are whether it's boards approving money for things that are fuzzy on the ROI, or a bunch of doctors say, golly, you cut my income in half, but I'm going to do it anyway, and that kind of stuff. So yeah, I think those are all factors.
Can I just add something to your answer from external observation? I'll state this as a hypothesis. Some of the ways I've seen your brethren fall is by getting committed to multi-tens of millions of dollars of projects over which they have no control, because they bought into, you know, Cerner's vision of enterprise computing, to pick on one particular example. And you seem to have been able to avoid that by having a good enough in-house development staff that you haven't gone for these big, blitzy, high-priced external solutions. Am I right that seems to be one of the things a lot of people...
Yes, well, I think it's fair, Pete. And when you back away from that, and sort of fun, because we've also bet the farm, you know, or close to it, in a way that you might bet the farm, you pick the vendor like Cerner, said, I'm going to commit to you for the rest of the time. I think what you have to be good at is saying, I'm about to undertake an initiative that has risk. Now, some risk is, you know, I think actually doing e-consoles as a pilot, not much risk there. If it doesn't work, there you're, you know, oh well, we learn. But other things like a Cerner have high risk. I think it's very intelligent, thoughtful to say, to one, recognize risk. So this thing is risky for whatever set of reasons. It can be a big system, it could be, you know, an infrastructure move, et cetera. And we have, from time to time, our order entry stuff was high risk of doing that stuff, is when you understand risky situations, first of all, you label them as such, and you make sure that the leadership's aware there's risk here, you know, non-trivial risk. So two things have to happen above and beyond that. One is, why would we do that? You know, and so you better be clear about the risk, because you better have a pretty good upside to justify this. The other is a thing we go through called, tell me how this sort of, it's called ways to die analysis. You know, if we take this initiative, what factors, what instances, what occurrences would cause this thing to head south? I mean, either head into the ground at 9,000 miles an hour or to be significantly impaired. And you just sit on the board. It's startling. Well, we could have the following things could really, you know, bite us in the ass and cause trouble. And I remember one particular initiative had 14 on the board, 14 factors. And then the question becomes, to the degree you can we make it go away? You know, can we take management steps, technical steps to remove it as a risk? Can we take management technical steps to mitigate, if it were to occur, to mitigate its damage? And there are some, invariably, there ain't nothing you can do about it. But so the next question becomes, if it occurs, it occurs into it 3 years, and zillions of dollars into it, I don't want to have to go back to zero. Can I go back a short distance and recover and be okay there? In other words, can I fall back to a reasonable position? I don't have to go all the way back to that one. And I think in some of those cases, and having been around, I've seen, you know, the revolving door in a couple of organizations here, I don't think there was that kind of analysis. And there was also painted with, you know, and I was, one of the places I went to in the last few days had this, and oh, Jesus. And I felt old and cynical all over again. You know, we're going to do this. And all of a sudden there were six doctors, and you would have thought they were, you know, and, excuse me, knowing adolescent females, I know how, you know, giddy 13-year-old girls. Oh, it's going to be wonderful. Oh, we're going to be able to do this. We're going to be able to do that. It's going to be wonderful. We're just going to put the computer in. It's going to be wonderful. What, are you shitting me? It's ugly. It's gruesome, et cetera. And so at times you get into sort of giddy where facts, you know, whatever facts were on the table are now gone. And rationality has been replaced by some cool drug that I wish they'd vended. So it turns into, they turn stupid. I'll give you a sort of corollary thing. There's, have you ever guys heard of the thing called advanced states of technical arousal? And I see it in my colleagues here, where you know they go to a trade show or they can read PC Week and they're just overwhelmed by the technology. You know, it's neural net, it's giga, you know, it's not giga, it's teraflops and it's, you know, petabytes and it's wireless and it's web enabled, et cetera. And they just get overwhelmed by the giddiness, and they turn stupid. It's amazing, you know, and you can see it in the you know, their pupils are dilated and they're flushed and they're shaken because, you know, and, you know, they got to have the latest, you know, sort of like some form of sexual experience is occurring here. It's unbelievable. So they turn stupid about all this stuff and they sort of forget, you know, why they were here. I mean, so what? What is it that we're going to do with it, et cetera, et cetera. So anyway, years ago, some of you probably read PC Week, you know, it comes out every now and then. But I was talking to Lauren Paul, who's a writer for PC Week. I said, Lauren, you're killing me. PC Week comes out Wednesday at noon. My staff gets it. 80% of them are advanced states of technical arousal within an hour. You know, they're page 57. Holy smokes, and get the Gorball 5,000. Look at this. And John, there's only 2,500 apiece. We need 1,000,000 right away. Lauren, it takes until noon Thursday before they're normal. You know, sooner or later it wears off. So actually, Lauren, if you could go to PC Monthly, I prefer it because that would only cost me a day a month rather than a day a week of productivity here. I remember telling this to a set of chiefs at the Mass General, who are a very smart group and very entrepreneurial often, is that they wanted to, they said, well, you know, they had seen this state of advanced technical arousal also, and they wanted to, and they said, you know, by and large, probably a good payer mix. You know, they're treated by good coverage, Blue Cross Blue Shield, high tech crowd, et cetera. So they were going to open up a center for the treatment for advanced states of technical arousal and make a fortune off it. Okay. Any other questions? Is that on tape too?
Yeah.
Okay. Yes.
Do any groups, I don't know how malpractice insurance works, but I was curious if given the sort of implications on malpractice that record systems have, if any malpractice providers actually end up taking that into consideration for premium rates or that sort of thing.
There are some cases where if you have an emergency department system, that will affect your malpractice rating in a positive way. I think but nonetheless, if you look at the malpractice dollar that we cover, you know, where is the bulk of it going? Really, two fundamental classes drive it. One is surgical mistakes. The second is kids born with problems. And so you wind up suing the obstetrician, the gynecologist. And there's not a clear IT answer to either one. So in some, you know, you're dealing with the smaller set of the malpractice experience. Well, we have actually a conversation with GE, which is sort of not the flip side of that, which I think is kind of interesting. They're clearly willing to do 50. They might be willing to do 100, where they pay you, the doctor, $100 per patient per year for every GE employee that you treat using a computerized record. Now, if you go back to that chart, $5,000 to $6,000 commercially up at the 10 to 12, let's see, 2,000 patients, if you covered half my panel, you pay for the cost of the darn thing. So that's a sort of an interesting analog, is where people will pay you, Empire Blue Cross Blue Shield pays hospitals an additional 5% if they use computerized order entry. So we may head into that kind of stuff. Anything else? I realize our time is nigh. I hope this has been interesting. And I wish you all the best out and about there, and thanks.
John, thank you very much. Terrific.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. That was great.
Guys, the homework here.
Let's see, I had to reset your screen to 800 by 600.
Oh, okay, that's okay.
So you can change it back.
I'll do it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.